We are honored to be with Anthony Lewis. He has written about the First Amendment in Freedom for the Thought We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon. When you talked about turning off the television, it takes me to another part of your consideration of the First Amendment, that we could turn off the television news because there were just all kinds of other places we could go for information that we thought was more reliable. And so, yes, we turned off those broadcast outlets for the news and buckled down and did some work. We went to the New Yorker, The Atlantic, Harper's, Mother Jones. I mean, people who were out there, as well as the big newspapers who were lagging behind. And then, of course, you talk about the bloggers who are sort of a flashback to the pamphleteers.
Exactly.
that the founders wanted to protect, so that you could have that little voice as well as the big establishment voice. This expansion of the ability to be expressive has real implications for the ability to govern ourselves, doesn't it?
It really is James Madison brought to life. It is like the pamphleteers. You're exactly right. Most people don't understand that, but it's really true.
That's because I read your book.
Well, we endorse that.
But there's one aspect of it that isn't so good, and you have to understand it. That is that the bloggers are full of opinions. They don't have a lot of facts because they don't have the resources. They can't find out about the Pentagon Papers. They can't find out about secret illegal wiretapping. They don't have reporters with the experience. They can't spend 6 months paying somebody to dig into a story. They can't do that. So what can they do? They can copy the New York Times or criticize the New York Times. That's their game. And it's wonderful, but somehow we have to find the resources to give us the facts. You know, the great proprietor of the Manchester Guardian, Mr. Scott, said, opinions are cheap, facts are dear.
Mm.
Well, the other thing that Paula didn't mention that we did go to is published books.
Mm-hmm.
The tenants, mm-hmm. I mean, we now have this 24-hour news cycle all day, every day. We're getting information, so-called, thrown at us. And in many ways, that's been as debilitating as anything else, because there's the impression that we know a great deal, and what we've got is a very little that has been expanded to fill the available space.
Little reflection.
Indeed.
Right. And we've found that if history does tend to repeat itself in some interesting ways, or at least, as I think you quote somebody saying, it rhymes. and going to books like yours that put these things in perspective, we found to be very important. If you understand the history, for example, of the Middle East just in the 20th century, a great deal of what is going on becomes clear. We just did a program with a guy who wrote a book about the First World War, about the American involvement in the First World War, about a specific battle, the Meuse Argonne. You can take that book and the events around it, the circumstances of the First War, and you can extract from that a series of events that followed from the First War and America's involvement in the First War, again, looking at the Middle East, but lots of other things, the Geneva Conventions, things around that. And it all comes back to where we are today. And failing to understand that diminishes our ability as citizens.
You're quite right. Books should be fed into the equation, because today it isn't only a book about history and the stories of the First Amendment, like mine. It's books about current events, mm-hmm. taking a much deeper, more profound look, say, at the way the Iraq War operates on the ground, or the treatment of prisoners, or the violation of the rights of citizens. These books, current books, have had a very, very powerful effect because they go well behind the scenes. They give you a lot of facts. They're not just theories. And you can't really know what you're talking about, these important current events, unless you've read the books.
We've been talking a lot about the press, as you do, and look through the the pulse of laws and interpretation of laws, all based on this First Amendment. And in addition to the press, we also have to talk about the individual. As I said earlier to you personally, I grew up in the McCarthy era. And you say that we took a serious hit in America to our rights and privileges and duties, responsibilities as citizens, a serious hit through the McCarthy era, because people, for the most part, for the vast most part, were not courageous and defaulted to conformity. having lived through and remembering, I was little, but boy, did it make an impression. Having lived through that time, the need for individuals as well as for established parts of the society to really take seriously these issues. It's more than just, oh, well, the press should do their job. Oh, well, we need to, you know, yeah, go, somebody else read those books and tell me what they said. It isn't cheap to be in a democracy. It takes work if you're going to govern yourself. And I fear that whether you're talking about America or the rest of the world, and we do talk with and to the rest of the world, and we affect the rest of the world, that it is that you gotta buck up and do the work if you're going to move past being ruled.
Well, you say you lived through the McCarthy period.
Oh, boy.
I certainly did, and I actually covered the Army-McCarthy hearings, and I knew the characters. I saw McCarthyism up close, and it was just as you described, very debilitating, very devastating to the American system. You have to understand, you don't want to be a dreamer about American history. This hasn't been. You said earlier about people think we live in this perfect democracy and so on. It's a wonderful system, but it hasn't always functioned perfectly. We've had periodic waves of repression from the very beginning of the Republic. 7 years after the First Amendment was added to the Constitution, we had a Sedition Act that made it a crime to criticize the President of the United States, and editors were sent to jail, lots of them. We had not only McCarthy, we had the Sedition Act in World War I. Thousands of Americans were sent to prison for saying completely, you know, tame things about the war. The censorship system is too burdensome, or the allocation of foods isn't fair, or something like that, and they went to prison.
I don't want to buy liberty bonds.
Yeah.
Or I refuse to kiss the flag.
Yes, I refuse to kiss the flag. And then we had the anti-radicalism of the 1920s, the Red Scare at that time. We had the removal of Japanese Americans from the West Coast during World War II. I mean, we've been through a lot of repressions in this country. We don't want to think we're perfect. We're not. And we've had a little difficulty lately.
Indeed, we have.
You also point to the dangers of the press getting too cozy with the people they cover.
Oh, boy.
And we have, of course, seen that in lots of different faces. In fact, Bob Schieffer was here a few years ago, two floors down. We did a program with him, and I think it was in the course of the program. I know it was in the course of the program, whether it was on the air or not, I'm not sure. He said, you know, George Bush is not such a bad guy. I go to the baseball game with him regularly and sit with his box, have a good, you know, we have beers or whatever they do, you know, eat peanuts together. And he's really not a bad guy. And I respect Bob Schieffer.
I do, too.
And I think he's done a lot of important work, and that perspective has to affect how effective you can be as a critic, as a journalist, newsman, whatever.
I entirely agree with you. It's a reason when I had started writing columns while I was the London correspondent of the New York Times, and then when I came back to this country, I chose deliberately not to live in Washington because I was afraid I didn't have enough backbone to stand up to the pull of hobnobbing with the great. It's all very easy, and I have a lot of respect for Bob Schieffer, as you do. It's all very easy to say he's a nice guy. I'm sure in some sense George Bush is a nice guy, but that doesn't qualify him to be president, and it doesn't qualify him to be immune to criticism. And it's so hard to criticize nice guys. You're invited to a grand dinner party in Washington, and you're sitting next to the wife of the Secretary of State. Or at the moment, the Secretary of State doesn't have a wife. But usually, in the past, Secretaries of State, we had Madeleine Albright, she didn't have one either, but mostly they've had wives, so I stick with that example. And you're sitting next to her, and you're thinking to yourself, can I really publish that critical column about what a fool her husband is? No, I guess I really can't.
Gotta
it's difficult.
It down. Yeah. Well, the third thing that you say all over the place in Freedom from the Thought We Hate and didn't say in this is he's also not above the law. The fact that the president and the current president, Bush, and his administration have acted as if they are above the law, this unitary presidency, the ability to say, I'm going to do what I want to do because I'm going to do it, that's monarchy. That's what we spent a lot of time and blood in 8 years saying, we're not going to do that. And this country isn't just the pain to the United States, it's the pain to the world. This is an idea that Abraham Lincoln reminds us we must protect, because when you yield to the kind of abuse of power to which you speak, terrible things happen.
There's an irony about your monarchy point. The advocates of what you call the unitary presidency, the idea that the president has limitless executive power, say that it was inherited from the British system of the king having these reserve powers. But even that isn't true. We revolted against George III, as you said, a long, bloody Revolutionary War. But by the time we revolted, Parliament had limited many of the historical powers of the king, and the king had to obey the law to a great extent and defer to Parliament. And now these people come along and say the president has no limits. He can wiretap your phones against a written statute. He can torture prisoners. And Congress, their legal opinion said, Congress can't stop him from torturing prisoners. Even if they pass a law saying you can't torture prisoners, the president can ignore it. Now, that's just shocking to me. I hope I'm not naive, but I just didn't believe a president would do that.
Well, and the only recourse under our system, under the Constitution, is impeachment.
Impeachment or another election.
Let us have a break and talk about this some more when we come back in just a moment with Anthony Lewis. A great pleasure to be with him here on The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I, Paula, invite you to be with us when we return in a moment.